The mare was dancing in a circle, and Isabella flung her hair back with a toss of her head. "I waited almost an hour for you," she said. "Affairs of state," Charza began. "Oh, that's no excuse, Pater. A promise is a promise." "Well, it's still not too late," he pointed out. And she laughed as she challenged him. "I'll race that old banger of yours down to the stables." And she booted the mare into a gallop. "Not fair," he called after her. "You've got too much of a start." But she turned in the saddle and stuck her tongue out at him. He ran to the jag, but she cut across North Field and was dismounted by the time he drove into the stable yard. She tossed her reins to a groom and ran to embrace him. Isabella had a variety of kisses, but this type, lingering and loving, with a little bit of ear nuzzling at the end, was reserved for when she badly wanted something from him, something that she knew he was going to try to refuse. While he pulled on his riding boots, she sat close beside him on the bench and told him a funny story about her sociology professor at university. "This huge shaggy St. Bernard wandered into the lecture theatre, and Prof. Jacobs was quick as a flash. 'Better that the dog should come to learning,' he said, 'than learning should go to the dogs.' She was a natural mimic." As they left the saddle room, she hugged his arm. "Oh, Daddy, if only I could find a boy like you. But they're all so utterly dreary." "Long may they remain that way," he wished fervently. He made a cup with his hands for her to mount, but she laughed at him and sprang to the saddle easily on those long, lovely legs. "Come on, slow coach, it'll be dark soon." Charza enjoyed being alone with her. She enchanted him with her mercurial changes of mood and subject. She had a quick mind and quirky sense of humour to go with her extraordinary face and body. But she alarmed him when she showed flashes of that restless refusal to concentrate for long on a single topic. Sean had been like that, needing constant stimulation to hold his interest, easily bored by anything that could not keep the same breathless pace that he set. Charza was amazed that Isabella had lasted out a year of university studies, but he was resigned to the fact that she wasn't going to graduate. Every time they discussed it, she was more disparaging of the academic life. Make-believe, she called it. Kid's stuff. And when he replied, "Well, Bella, you are still a kid," she bridled at him. "Oh, Daddy, you don't understand." "Don't I? Don't you think I was your age once?" "Oh, I suppose so. But that was in biblical times, for God's sake." "Ladies don't swear," he remonstrated automatically. She attracted admirers in slavish droves and treated them with callous indifference for a while and then dropped them with almost feline cruelty. And all the time, the restlessness in her was more apparent. "I should have been stricter with her from the beginning," he decided grimly, and then grinned. "Oh, what the hell, she's my only indulgence, and she'll be gone soon enough." "Do you know that when you smile like that, you are the sexiest man in the world?" she interrupted his thoughts. "What do you know about sexiness, young lady?" he demanded gruffly to cover his gratification, and she tossed her head at him. "Wouldn't you like to know?" "No, thank you," he refused hastily. "I'd probably have a hernia on the spot." "My poor old daddy." She edged the mare over until their knees touched, and she leaned across to hug him. "All right, Bella," he smiled. "You'd better tell me what you want. Your heavy artillery has demolished my defences entirely." "Oh, daddy, you make me seem so scheming. I'll race you down to the polo grounds." He let her lead, holding his stallion's nose just behind her stirrup all the way down the hill. Nonetheless, she was flushed with triumph as she pulled in the mare and turned back to him. "I had a letter from Mater," she said. For a moment, Charza didn't realise what she had said. Then his smile iced over, and he glanced at his gold Rolex wristwatch. "We better be getting back. I want to talk to you about my mother. We haven't talked about her since the divorce." "There isn't anything to discuss. She's out of our lives." "No," Isabella shook her head. "She wants to see me and Mickey. She wants us to go to London and visit her." "No," he said fiercely. "Well, she's my mother." "She signed away all claim to that title." "I want to see her. She wants to see me." We'll talk about it some other time." "I want to talk about it now. Why won't you let me go?" "Your mother did things which put her beyond the pale. She would exert an influence of evil upon you." "Oh, nobody influences me, unless I want them to," she said. "And what did Mother do, anyway? Nobody has ever explained that." "She committed an act of calculated treachery, She betrayed us all, her husband, her father, her family, her children, and her country. Oh, I don't believe it, Isabella shook her head. Mater was always so concerned for everybody. I cannot and will not give you all the details, Bella. Just believe me when I tell you that if I had not spirited her out of the country, she would have stood trial as an accessory to the murder of her own father and for the crime of high treason. They rode up to the stables in silence, but as they entered the yard and dismounted, Isabella said quietly, "She should have had the chance to explain it to me herself." "I can forbid you to go, Bella. You're still a minor. But you know I won't do that. I'll simply ask you not to go to London to see that woman." "I'm sorry, Daddy. Mickey's going and I'm going with him." She saw his expression and went to him quickly. "Oh, please try to understand. I love you, but I love her too. I have to go." They drove up to the house in the Jaguar without speaking again. But as he parked the car and switched off the ignition, Shaza asked, "When?" "We haven't decided yet." "I tell you what. We'll go together sometime, and perhaps we could go on to Switzerland for a week skiing, or Italy, to do some sightseeing. We might even stop in Paris to get you a new frock. Lord knows you're short of clothes." "My dear father, you are a crafty old dog, aren't you?" They were still laughing as they went arm in arm up the front steps of Veltefrieden. Santone came out of her study door across the lobby. When she saw them, she snatched the gold-rimmed reading glasses off her nose. She hated even the family to see her wearing them, and she demanded, "What are you two so merry about? Bella is wearing her triumphant expression. What has she talked you into this time?" Santone didn't wait for an answer, but pointed to the huge banana-shaped package, almost 10 foot long, wrapped in thick layers of brown hessian, that lay in the middle of the checkered marble floor. "Shaza, this arrived for you this morning, and it has been cluttering up the house all day. Please get rid of it, whatever it is." Santone had lived alone at Rhodes Hill for almost a year after Blaine's death, before Shaza had been able to persuade her to close the house up and return to Veltefrieden. Now she ran a strict routine, to which they were all expected to conform. "Now what on earth is this?" Shaza tentatively attempted to lift one end of the long package, and then grunted. "It's made of lead, whatever it is." "Hold on, Pater," Gary called from the top of the staircase. "You'll bust something." He came bounding down the stairs, three at a time. "I'll do that for you. Where do you want it?" "The gunroom will do. Thanks, Gary." Gary enjoyed showing off his strength, and he lifted the heavy package easily and manoeuvred it down the passageway, then through the gunroom door, and laid it on the lion skin in front of the fireplace. "Do you want me to open it?" he asked, and without waiting for an answer, went to work on it. Isabella perched on the desk, determined not to miss anything, and none of them spoke until Gary had stripped away the last sheet of hessian and stood back. "It's magnificent," Shaza breathed. "I have never seen anything quite like that in my life before." It was a single tusk of curved ivory, almost 10 foot long, as thick as a pretty girl's waist at one end, and tapering to a blunt point at the other. "It must weigh almost 150 pounds, Gary said. "But just look at the workmanship." Shaza knew that the ivory workers of Zanzibar were the only ones who could do something like this. The entire length of the tusk had been carved with hunting scenes of exquisite detail and the finest execution. "It's beautiful." Even Isabella was impressed. "Who sent it to you?" "There's an envelope." Shaza pointed to the litter of discarded wrappings, and Gary picked it out and passed it to him. The envelope contained a single sheet of notepaper. "In camp on the Tana River, Kenya. Dear Dad, happy birthday. I'll be thinking of you on the day. This is my best jumbo to date, 146 pounds before the carving. Why don't you come hunting with me? Love, Sean." With the note in one hand, Shaza squatted beside the tusk and stroked the creamy, smooth surface. The carvings depicted a herd of elephant, hundreds of them in a single herd. From old bulls and breeding cows to tiny calves, they fled in a long spiral frieze around the ivory shaft, diminishing in elegant perspective towards the point. The herd was harassed and attacked by hunters along its length, beginning with men in lion skins armed with bows and poisoned arrows, or with broad-bladed elephant spears. Towards the end of this primeval cavalcade, the hunters were on horseback and wielding modern firearms. The path of the herd was strewn with great fallen carcasses, and it was beautiful and real and tragic. However, it was neither the beauty nor the tragedy that thickened Shaz's voice as he said, "Will you two leave me alone, please?" He did not look around at them. He did not want them to see his face. For once, Isabella did not argue, but took Gary's hand and led him from the room. "He hasn't forgotten my birthday," Shaza murmured as he stroked the ivory. "Not once since he left." He coughed and stood up abruptly, jerked the handkerchief from his breast pocket, and blew his nose loudly, and then wiped his eyes. "And I haven't even written to him. I haven't even replied to one of his letters." He stuffed the handkerchief back into his pocket and went to stand at the window, staring out over the lawns where the peacock strutted. "The stupid, cruel thing is that he has always been my favourite of the three of them. Oh, God, I'd give anything to see him again." The rain was icy grey, drifting like smoke over the thick forests of bamboo that cloaked the crests of the Aberdare Mountains. The four of them moved in single file, with the Ndrobo tracker on the point, following the spoor in the forest earth that beneath the litter of fallen bamboo leaves was the colour and consistency of molten chocolate. Sean Courtney took the second position, covering the tracker and poised to make any quick decision. He was the youngest of the three white men, but command had quite naturally devolved upon him. Nobody had contested it. The third man in the line, Alistair Sparks, was the youngest son of a Kenyan settler family. Although he possessed enormous powers of endurance, was a fine natural shot and a consummate bushman, he was lazy and evasive and needed to be pushed to exercise all his skills to the full. Raymond Harris was on the drag at number four. He was almost 50 years old, full of malaria and gin, but in his time had been one of the legendary white hunters of East Africa. He had taught Sean everything he knew, until the pupil had excelled the master. Now Raymond was content to bring up the rear and let Sean and Matatu, the tracker, get them into position for the kill. Matatu was naked, except for his filthy, tattered loincloth, and the rain made tiny rivulets down his glossy black hide. He worked the spoor with the same instinct and superhuman sense of sight, smell, and hearing as one of the wild animals of the forest. They had been following these tracks for 2 days already, stopping only when the light failed completely each night, and taking up the chase again with the first flush of dawn. The spoor was running sweet and hot. Sean was probably as good a tracker as a white man could be, and he judged that they were only 4 or 5 hours behind, and gaining swiftly. The quarry had angled up the steep slope of this nameless peak, heading to cross the ridge just below the main crest. Sean caught glimpses of the top through the dense vault of bamboo over their heads and the blown streamers of misty rain. Suddenly Matatu stopped dead, and Sean popped his tongue to warn the others and froze with his thumb on the safety catch of the big double-barreled Gibbs. After a moment Matatu turned abruptly aside, dropping the spoor, and went sliding as swiftly and silently as a dark serpent down the slope, away from the line and direction of the quarry. 5 years before, when Sean had first taken Matatu into his service, he might have protested and tried to force him to stay with the run of the spoor. But now he followed without argument, and although he was going at his best hunting speed, he just managed to hold the tracker in sight. Sean was dressed in a cloak of colobus monkey skins, and he wore Somali sandals of elephant hide on his feet, and a shaggy cap of monkey skin covered his obviously Caucasian hair. His arms, legs and face were blackened with a mixture of rancid hippo fat and soot, and he had not bathed in 2 weeks. He looked and smelled like the men he was hunting. There were 5 Mau Mau in the band that they were pursuing, all of them members of the notorious gang run by the self-styled General Kamati. 5 days previously they had attacked one of the coffee shambas near Nyeri in the foothills of the mountain range. They had disemboweled the white overseer and stuffed his several genitals into his mouth, and they had chopped off his wife's limbs with the heavy-bladed pangas, beginning at wrist and ankle and working gradually towards the trunk of her body, until they hacked through the great joints in her shoulders and groin. Sean and his group of scouts had reached the Shamba almost 12 hours after the gang had fled. They had left the Land Rover and taken the spoor on foot. Matatu took them directly down the slope. The narrow river at the bottom was a tumultuous silver torrent. Sean stripped off his furs and sandals and went into it naked. The cold chilled his bones until they ached, and the roaring waters swirled over his head, but he carried the line across and then brought the others safely over. Matatu was the last to cross, carrying Sean's clothing and his rifle, and immediately he was off again, like a wraith of the forest. Sean followed him, with the agony of cold shuddering through his body, and the sodden furs a heavy burden to add to the rifle and his pack. A herd of buffalo crashed away through the forest ahead of them, and the bovine stink lingered in their nostrils long after they were gone. Once Sean had a glimpse of a huge antelope, ginger-red with vertical white stripes down its heavy body, and a head of magnificent spiral horns. It was a bongo. He would have charged one of his rich American clients $1,000 for a shot at that rarest and most elusive of all antelopes. But it ghosted away into the bamboo, and Matatu led them on without apparent purpose or direction, the spoor 3 hours cold behind them. Then Matatu skirted one of the rare forest clearings and stopped again. He glanced back over his naked shoulder and grinned at Sean with the patent adoration of a hunting dog who acknowledges the most important being in his universe. Sean stepped up beside him and looked down at the spoor. He would never know how Matatu did it. He had tried to make him explain, but the wizened little gnome had merely laughed with embarrassment and hung his head. It was a kind of magic that went beyond the mere art of observation and deduction. What Matatu had just done was to drop the spoor when it was sweet and hot, and go off at an improbable tangent, running blind through tactless bamboo and over wild peaks, to meet the spoor again with the unerring instinct of a migrating swallow, having cut the corner and gained 3 hours on the quarry. Sean squeezed his shoulder, and little Ndorobo wriggled his whole body with pleasure. They were less than an hour behind the gang now, but the rain and the mist were bringing on the night prematurely. Sean signalled Matatu on. Not one of them had spoken a single word all that day. The men they were chasing were becoming careless. In the beginning, they had anti-tracked and covered spoor, doubled and jinked so cunningly that even Matatu had puzzled to unravel the sign and get away on the run of it. But now they were feeling confident and secure. They had broken off the succulent bamboo shoots to chew as they marched, leaving glaring wounds on the plants, and they had trodden deeply, healing with fatigue, leaving sign that Matatu could follow like a tarmac road. One of the fugitives had even defecated on the track, not bothering to cover his feces, and they were still steaming with his body warmth. Matatu grinned at Sean over his shoulder and made the fluttery hand signal which said, "Very close."